Welcome again to the latest episode in the ISI Flyby podcast series. Today, we're looking at what is arguably the most underrated aspect of modern technology, the satellite. Well, thousands of satellites now whiz around the globe over our heads, but it's a fair guess that very, very few of us even give them a second thought. Well, nowadays, they're responsible for many of the most critical elements of our lives, like communication, entertainment, navigation, weather forecasting, environment monitoring, and of course, defense. Well, today's guest is Andrew Cawthorne, who is currently Director of Earth Observation and Customer Training for one of the most successful satellite builders in the world, the UK company Surrey Satellite Technology Limited. SSTL, as it is more widely known as, is now a subsidiary of Airbus, the giant European aerospace business, which has built everything from the largest passenger aircraft ever to fly, the A380, to the massive and highly successful Ariane rocket family. Well, let's get started, and we begin by asking Andrew where SSTL started and how it has grown.
Yes, certainly. So, I mean, SSTL started about 40 years ago. In fact, we had the 40th anniversary of our first satellite launch just this week.
Congratulations.
It was the brainchild of our founder and chairman, Professor Sir Martin Sweeting. And at the time he was working at the University of Surrey, and space back then was very much limited to big governments and military organizations, really. And there was no idea of a small satellite. But Martin and the team back at the University of Surrey then kind of had this idea that maybe they could use this fledgling commercial off-the-shelf technology, the kind of electronics that was being used in kind of consumer devices at the time, to build a very different kind of satellite. And that was the idea. And it was a bit kind of heretical at the time. Everybody kind of had a look at this and thought, well, that's clearly never going to work. They persevered, and they built their first satellite, which was called USAT-1. And they sweet-talked NASA into giving them a free launch on one of the rockets that they had going up. And they tested this satellite out. And I think to everybody's surprise, it worked very well. They had a lot of success, really. They had a very simple camera on it at the time. You know, it was a kind of 256 by 256 pixels. So very coarse images. But for a satellite like that, I mean, this was completely unheard of. And so what's kind of really happened since then is that Martin and the team, and that team kind of became Surrey Satellite Technology Limited, the company that we are now, continued to kind of develop that idea of building satellites in a different way. It took quite a while before it kind of caught on. But now that approach is kind of widely adopted by the space industry. So there is of course still a place for the big satellites built the traditional way, but a lot more satellites now are kind of built by this kind of new space approach, small satellite approach, which is bringing in at a very different kind of size and price point. So that's been, you know, what SSTL is about. We kind of continued that kind of pioneering spirit, I suppose, through some of the projects that we are doing now. We have just kicked off a satellite that we're building called Lunar Pathfinder, which will be our first satellite that's going to the moon, which is very exciting.
Yeah. That is exciting.
Yeah. Again, it's a little different to normal in the sense that we are operating a commercial service providing communications relay from the moon. So there is a lot of talk at the moment from the space agencies, ESA and NASA and others, about going back to the moon exploration activities, taking astronauts back to the moon. And what Lunar Pathfinder is about is providing the communication services for those missions that will go to the moon. So over the next 10 years or so, there will be lots of missions going, particularly if you're going to the far side of the moon. Of course, you can't see the Earth at all. The moon is in the way. So you need to have some kind of communications relay satellite in orbit. And that's what Lunar Pathfinder is about. We'll provide the ability to connect those moon missions back to the Earth without them having to carry their own very large transmitters and so on that they would normally require.
As far as I understand, the Chinese have one very similar to that that's acting as a relay for their own missions on the far side of the moon. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So they had a far side mission that launched fairly recently. And indeed, yes, in order to communicate with that, they have to have a relay satellite in orbit. I guess what's going on there, of course, is that was, I suppose, dedicated for that far side mission. The difference with Pathfinder is that it's being made as a service provision for anybody who wants to have that kind of communication back to Earth. Mm.
So you're putting it up there now as a commercial venture is quite an astute venture, isn't it? It's getting in with the market.
Well, let's hope so. Yes, indeed. We are support. You know, the European Space Agency has come on board as an anchor customer for us, so that at least that takes some of the risk out of it, because they know, of course, that they're going to go there and they're teamed with NASA as well. So, yeah, a few customers already signed up.
It's really exciting, isn't it?
It's fascinating.
Satellites now around Mars, around the moon, but the huge bulk of satellites, of course, is still around the Earth, isn't it?
It certainly is, yes. And for the 71 satellites that we've built and launched to date, yes, they have so far all been around the Earth.
How would you deal with the overcrowding issues? Do they collide at all?
I mean, yes, but space is a fairly big space, but you're right, it is getting a bit more crowded up there. I think, just if you consider some of the numbers, really, between 1957, when the first satellite went up, and 2020, there are about 9,000 satellites launched altogether. Mm. If you consider that about 1,200 of those satellites launched in 2020 on its own.
Wow.
And actually this year we surpassed that number before we were halfway through the year. As a globe, that's all the satellites that were launched. So I mean, it is skyrocketing upwards in terms of the numbers that are going up there.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
But most of these new satellites are the small ones, the Starlink and OneWeb satellites that are providing or are supposed to be providing internet services.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I guess it depends on your definition of small. They're not small. They're not the smallest kind of satellites. I mean, you know, the smallest being the kind of CubeSats, 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters type things. There certainly are a lot more of those going up these days. But I mean, Starlink and OneWeb are still, reasonable size in that they are, 100, more than 100 kilos type thing. Now, yeah, that's certainly not anywhere near the biggest. I mean, if you consider, I don't know whether it's the biggest, but something like Envisat, which the European Space Agency launched some years ago, was about eight tons. Yeah. And about the size of a double-decker bus. So, yes, they're definitely small in relation to that. But still bigger than some of the very small satellites that are launching at the moment.
Wow,
that's really useful, actually. Thank you. It's given us a good context. The way that I suppose most people think of satellites as being a box in the air that beams signals to Earth, because that's exactly the way we've been sort of trained to think of them. Just how complex is a modern satellite?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question, really. I mean, we try to keep the satellites relatively simple. And the reason for that, of course, is that you can't go up and fix it. A lot of the work that we put into the satellite is in making sure that it's going to work and that it's going to stay working for the 7, 10, 15 years or so that it's going to be up there. So there has to be a kind of fine balance between using new ideas, you know, new technology and so on, and also doing things that you know are going to work, because, you know, different customers, different organizations, I guess, have a different appetite for that risk, and you need to find the right balance in there. You know, that said, the kind of small satellite approach has always been to try and you know, by using this commercial technology, you are able to make use of, you know, more recent components and you know, technologies, which does enable you to be doing things, you know that are, you know, a bit more complicated. But yes, in the end, it is a box full of electronics, you know, very similar to your you know, what you might find in your computer at home.
Yeah. But when it comes down to it, we've got these very vulnerable pieces of electronic equipment up there. How do you shield them? How do you keep them safe from solar radiation, magnetism,
space
other
junk,
electronic, and other space junk? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so it depends, of course, where you are. For most of the satellites that we build, and indeed, you know, a large number of the satellites overall, they are in what's called low Earth orbit, which is a region which is, you know, up to maybe 1,000 kilometers above the surface of the Earth, and with, I guess, probably most of them in the range of 500 to 700 kilometers up, and there at least the radiation environment is relatively benign. I mean, or at least a lot better than it is in other places in space. Anyway.
Yeah.
And so you can shield the electronics from what's called the total dose that they are exposed to, the total amount of radiation that they will receive over their lifetime, and you typically do that by kind of encasing them in an appropriate amount of metal, aluminium shielding, for example. We would put our electronics in a box which has got at least a good few millimeters of aluminium around it to protect it from the radiation. Of course, you know, it's not just total dose that we have to worry about. It. There are also kind of events that are triggered by, you know, particles of radiation, and that is about making sure you have designed the electronics to cope with that. And you know, there are different ways of doing that. You could have several bits of electronics that are all doing the same thing, so that if one of them fails or goes glitches in some way, then the other parts can pick it up. So yes, so that's kind of radiation. In terms of in terms of how do you avoid everything else that's up there? Well, that is becoming an increasing problem. There are you know, more and more bits of debris now floating around. We get it is possible, and of course all of those bits of debris are being tracked. There are various organizations around the world that are following all of those bits, well, at least down to a certain size anyway, below which it gets a little tricky.
27,000 pieces or something.
Yes, indeed. And so we get, as a satellite operator, we get notifications from some of those organizations, and that notification might well say, you know, tomorrow there is a 37% chance that this piece of debris is going to come within within 150 meters of your satellite.
Like a weather report.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then what we have to do as an operator is taking that piece of information, decide whether we're going to do anything, and indeed what we're going to do, because you don't want to move the satellite and actually make the probability of it hitting something worse.
Yeah, of course.
Because you don't know for sure exactly where this bit of debris is going to be. Well, certainly the number of times that we get those kind of collision warnings is going up pretty sharply at the moment. Yeah. It used to be a fairly rare occurrence. It's now, you know, something that we deal with on a you know, several times a week basis.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And of course, if you have to move a satellite, that just takes up more fuel, doesn't it, from the
that's right.
Motors,
Yeah, exactly. So they will all launch with a limited amount.
Yeah.
Once it's gone, it's gone.
Yeah, and that shortens the life, of course, which makes the economics a lot more difficult.
Yes, quite.
Yeah. Especially for companies like yourself. I mean, some of these satellites that are up there are massive. Some of the Inmarsats and the Earth observation satellites, communication satellites, and so on, do weigh in excess of 10 tons. I mean, how do you as a company work out the economics of that when you're looking at a launch?
Well, that's certainly an interesting question. I mean, for us, we are operating in a much smaller range than that. Our satellites tend to be in there. Most of our satellites, are probably in the 50 to 200 kilogram range.
Right.
So quite a lot smaller than those kind of beasts. You do have to look at the economics of it, launch to buy a launch. You can buy a launch on the commercial market, and that is what we do for a lot of our launches, our satellites. And you'll pay anywhere from $10,000 a kilogram to maybe $40,000 a kilogram, depending on the rocket and exactly where you're going.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you're launching a very large satellite, then you've got to multiply each of those kilos by a fairly high price.
Yes.
What about the opposite for that in terms of decommissioning and deorbiting? How do you take that into consideration? Is that something that you've got to deal with on a regular?
So it is, and I mean, there are new kind of regulations coming into place now as the responsible nations around the world are saying to themselves, well, we need to make sure we are keeping this debris problem under control. Mm. So at the moment, the regulations say that you need to make sure that your satellite won't stay in orbit for more than, in low Earth orbit at least, it won't stay in orbit for more than 25 years after it's finished its mission.
Right.
And what that generally means is that you need to make sure that it finishes up in a low enough altitude that over time, over that 25-year period, the very little atmosphere that still exists up at that height will eventually have enough of a drag effect on the satellite that it will slow down and it will gradually get lower and lower and lower until eventually it burns up in the atmosphere. So we have to make sure when we're building a satellite that beyond the amount of propellant that it will need to keep it doing whatever we want it to do for that mission, it then has enough that we can then use that propellant to lower the altitude to this point where we can be sure it will burn up within 25 years.
One of the things, Andrew, that I read recently was that there is some concern now about the environmental effects of satellite re-entry and burning up and the noxious gases and various components. So some of the components are toxic and burn up in the atmosphere but leave residue. Is this a concern to a company like your own?
I guess it depends a little bit on you know, what kinds of things you're putting into the satellites. I mean, certainly at the small end, it's for the kind of satellites that we're building, I guess it's much less of a problem. I guess maybe for some of the big satellites that are, you know, doing odd things, maybe that is more of a concern. Certainly there are becoming more regulations now in terms of what you can and can't do. Just, you know, the idea of deorbiting within 25 years is one aspect of it, but there are also other aspects in terms of the probabilities that something that is re-entering won't burn up, you know, and might actually survive to hit the ground. And so all of these kinds of things are you know, kind of maybe legislated is too strong a word, but at least regulated.
Yeah. And I mean, presumably you have to take out insurance on that if you had a satellite that was big enough not to burn up completely.
Insurance would be big. We do. And we have to have insurance for the satellites whilst they're in orbit as well, in case they hit something while they're there.
Oh, God.
Yeah. That's interesting. Quite. So it's a bit that part of it is quite difficult. One of the things I'd like to get back to, though, was this question of how you regulate the satellite itself in order to get the best out of it. Because I know that cameras on Earth, if you have a camera in a satellite, it's going to get very, very cold. And sometimes some of the sensors in satellites need to be kept cold. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. That's right. I mean, space, yes, can be a very cold place. It can also be a very hot place, depending on you know, which way you happen to be pointing. So one of the challenges when we are designing a satellite is to make sure that all of the bits of it are kept at the right temperature. For the kind of satellites that we build using these commercial parts, then most of these commercial electronic parts are rated to work between about minus 20 degrees and about plus 50 degrees.
Right.
So we are going through the design of the satellite to ensure that all of the components are kept within that range. Now, you can do that for the bits on the inside by making sure that you've put the right surfaces on the outside of the satellite so that they absorb or reflect just the right amounts of sunlight depending on exactly how they're flying around and so on. So you can do that, and in cases where you can't quite do that, then you can put heaters on board as well that will switch on when it gets cold and switch off when it gets warm and so on. There are particular things, but yes, some of the cameras, for example, where you need to keep them at a very particular temperature. And of course, that just kind of goes into the design problem where you're saying, well, okay, fine, now I need to make sure that I'm going to bias that bit of it cold and you know, potentially use heaters to regulate it and make sure it's being kept at exactly the right temperature. But yeah, it's all part of that complex design problem that happens when we are first putting one of these satellites together.
And most of them are powered by solar arrays, is that correct?
Yes, that's right, yeah. So it's they are relatively little power, actually. I mean, for one of our satellites, again, which is in that kind of maybe 100, 200 kilo range, you might well be operating off 100 or 200 watts of power. Wow. So, I mean, probably a bit old-fashioned these days, but of course, fairly similar to what you used to have in a light bulb, at least. That's probably not probably not the case anymore. But you are generating that power from solar arrays, which are, you know, pointing at the sun and gathering those photons to keep going.
I have read that, again, that some satellites further out in geostationary probably have battery power or nuclear power, even, and especially the military ones.
Most satellites would have a battery of some kind on board, just because you can't rely on the sun being there the whole time. Certainly in low Earth orbit, you're going to go behind the Earth for some parts of the orbit, and so you need a battery to keep going then. I think the, you know, kind of nuclear powered satellites are a lot less common. there have been those kinds of things have been used particularly for some of the exploration missions out into the wider solar system, where you can't rely on the solar power. I mean, once the satellite, you know, gets out into the outer planets, then the amount of solar energy is very low, and you need to do something a little different. For now, at least, those kinds of things are relatively uncommon elsewhere.
And SSTL are not going to be building any interplanetary probes soon.
Not currently. No, indeed, we did have a reaction wheel that was on the Rosetta lander, lander, which was quite exciting. But so far, no full missions built. The moon is the furthest we're going at the moment, but maybe beyond that in the future.
Watch this space.
It's pretty impressive, though, even going to the moon. I mean, what special problems will you have in building a satellite to orbit the moon?
Well, certainly the radiation environment is different. We talked about that earlier.
Yeah,
it isn't quite as benign as it is around in low Earth orbit close to the Earth.
And so, just to make that clear, that's because of the Van Allen belts. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. And actually, probably one of the worst places to be is if your satellite is actually operating in those belts, because then they trap a lot of the radiation. So it's
yeah, of course.
Yeah, we have. I mean, people do have to design satellites to work in that environment, and that's where you kind of really have to take these things into account. But the moon, at least, is probably somewhere in between. The radiation environment isn't quite as bad as it would be in a medium Earth orbit, but it's certainly worse than it would be in a low Earth orbit. So, yeah, certain approaches need to be taken in terms of the shielding and also how the electronics is designed to be able to cope with that.
Apart from that, it's pretty much the same as building an Earth orbiting satellite.
It's certainly very similar. There are a few things. I mean, of course, you're orbiting a different body, and we've got different orbital dynamic problems that we have to deal with.
Yeah.
And you can't. I mean, some satellites, for example, although it's a little less common these days, might have sensors on them that detect the Earth to help them orient themselves. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you can't do that around the moon. So. So a few different things, and I guess one of the other elements, which actually our satellite is part of a project which is looking into, is knowing where it is. So in orbit around the Earth, you can actually use the GPS and the Galileo satellites that are in orbit to tell where you are. So a lot of the satellites in low Earth orbit will have a GPS receiver or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
On them, and they are picking up the GPS signals in the same way that you do in your car or your phone.
Yeah.
In order to locate themselves. Obviously, at the moment, there are no GPS satellites around the moon, and the GPS signals that you can pick up, you can just about pick up the Earth GPS signals from the moon, but they are very, very weak. So knowing where you are is a bit more of a challenge. And the next step, in fact, for our Lunar Pathfinder mission will be a lunar communications and navigation system constellation. So the plan is to put some further satellites around the moon to provide that navigation capability in order that the various missions to the moon will be able to rely on an equivalent GPS signal around the moon to know where they are.
And that would, and presumably that will help people actually traveling on the moon if we ever get to that point. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
So everybody knows where they are.
Yes. Yeah. And none of the astronauts will lose their rovers.
Oh, yeah. We've had several of those in the past.
Forget where they've parked.
That's fascinating, Andrew. The whole thing about satellites having started, 70 years ago now, and the way that the technology and the companies have come on, how do you see the British satellite industry developing? Because I understand that we're quite well ahead in these respects.
Yes, we are. I think it's good. The UK government has identified space as something that they're very keen on, and they're very supportive of the activities that are going on related to space. I think at the moment, the UK, I think is certainly in the top five in terms of the number of satellites that are operated out of the UK. So we are, a relatively high user of space. I think, at the moment, there are various plans, I suppose, afoot. I mean, the UK is part of the European Space Agency, and so we do participate in a lot of the European Space Agency missions. Of course, there was a recent astronaut call where UK UK citizens are eligible to apply as well. So maybe we'll see a second Tim Peake coming in future years.
Yeah.
Certainly there are a lot of plans around so the National Space Strategy was just published just very recently, and the UK government sets out what their aims are for space over the coming years, and looking at things like how they can help with climate change, and how they can help with keeping space sustainable, how to help with the debris problem, and so on. So there's a number of kind of themes in there that the UK is pushing forward over the coming years.
And of course, there are these space launch sites developing now quite quickly in Scotland. Would SSTL be using them for any of their satellites into polar orbit? Or
I hope so.
Yeah.
So we are absolutely keen, and we are, part of some of the certainly working with some of the organisations who are looking at doing that. For us, it's all about, as a commercial organisation, it's all about where can we get a good price.
Yeah.
So hopefully the UK launches will come with a nice price tag, and certainly we will be queuing up to buy them if that's the case.
Yeah, quite. I mean. Would horizontal launch be something? I understand that's up to about 500 kilos that Virgin can offer in horizontal launch. Is that something you're looking into?
Yes, indeed. And we have done a bit of work recently on a contract with Virgin, looking at launching one of our satellites on their rocket too. I mean, I think one of the neat things, I suppose, about the horizontal launch that Virgin is offering is that it's not tied to a particular location in terms of it's not fixed to a launch site.
Yeah.
If there's a runway, okay, you need maybe a little bit of logistical support.
Yeah.
but at least if there is a runway, then you can take off and therefore potentially launch the satellite from a lot of different places, which, for military organisations and so on, has quite a large interest.
Yeah, and presumably to some commercial organisations as well, as long as they can get the right price, as you say.
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, in many ways, your job seems to be an extremely interesting one, and one that is very apposite for modern life and Earth observation. What exactly does that involve?
Well, Earth observation, I suppose, is the idea of having some kind of camera in orbit that is looking down at the ground to achieve something. And there are a variety of applications where that kind of comes into play. At the coarsest level, of course, Earth observation feeds into our weather forecasting, and they would have kind of very wide, wild field of view. Cameras that are, getting a very global picture of the Earth and seeing, of course, what's going on with the clouds and so on, and that's all feeding into the weather forecast. At the other end of the scale, of course, we also have cameras up there that are delivering a very, very high resolution in the kind of tens of centimeters range, wow. Which then get used for, certainly, of course, defense and security applications, but also urban planning and that kind of thing. And then probably in the middle too, there is a lot of satellite Earth observation data is used for agricultural purposes. A lot of kind of crop monitoring is done using space data these days. What the satellites do is they can, you know, as they're flying over a farm, they will take an image of the of all of the fields, and then by analyzing that data, you can actually understand what the crop health is, which parts of the field the crops are doing well, which parts of the fields they're not doing so well, and then you can feed that data down into a system on board the tractor, so that the farmer can make sure that the right amount of fertilizer is applied to the different parts of the field, so that they're not wasting fertilizer on the bit of the field that's already doing well, and they're making sure they are focusing on the bit that isn't, so that you can make that whole process a lot more efficient.
That something that's just experimental at the moment, or is that something that farmers are actually paying money to use?
Oh no, yeah, it's very much an operational thing. Yeah, this is used, you know, very widely in the farming industry.
Yeah, and I understand there are satellites now that are measuring the surface temperature of the ocean to track ocean currents, that sort of thing.
Oh yes, absolutely. I mean, all sorts of different applications, and we've actually just started building another satellite called HydroGNSS, which is strictly an Earth observation satellite, although it's doing it not with a camera this time. This is actually using GPS signals again. So the GPS signals come down from space, they bounce off the surface of the Earth. We can pick up those very weak signals on the satellite in orbit. And depending on exactly how those signals have changed, you can obviously pick up the signal direct from the GPS satellite, so you can compare how the reflected signals compare to the ones that have come directly, and you can tell properties about the surface of the Earth as a result.
That's incredible.
And things like bouncing off the surface of the sea, you can then start telling, well, what's the wave height, and therefore what is the wind speed that's blowing across those oceans.
What excites you most about being in this business at the moment?
I think, I mean, there is so much going on. There is so much going on at the moment. Space is definitely an exciting place to be. And if you look at, I guess one of the challenges with satellites has always been, you know, how can you cost effectively get stuff up into space? And if you look at some of the advances that are going on in the launcher industry at the moment, I mean, that is coming on in leaps and bounds, which is kind of opening up the possibility in orbit a lot more. I think also we are getting to the point where we can look at, you know, what kinds of things might we be able to do in orbit in the future, picking up on some of the advanced terrestrial things like 3D printing, for example.
Yeah.
Can we get to the point where in orbit we can build the satellite? One of the big challenges for the satellite is surviving the launch phase. You build this very delicate satellite with a kind of critically tuned telescope, and then you put it on a rocket and you shake it to pieces. Well, hopefully not to pieces. You shake it, and, you know,
you give like it a great, violent shake. Yeah.
Yes, and then you need to make sure that it's still working when it gets into orbit. So, you know, now people are looking at, well, can we, instead of doing that, can we launch the component parts into orbit and build a satellite in orbit instead, and that kind of in-space manufacturing or the in orbit robotics is definitely a kind of fledgling part of what's going on in space, but with some really exciting possibilities.
Has anybody ever tried that in the International Space Station yet, actually building a small CubeSat and then launching it?
So they certainly have had, I don't know whether they still do, had a 3D printer on the space station, which they have used for printing, you know, tools and so on that they have then used on the space station. I'm not aware that they've ever built a CubeSat on the space station. They certainly have launched satellites from the space station.
Yeah.
We built a satellite that was launched from the space station a few years ago. At the time, certainly the biggest that what had been launched from the space station, a satellite called Remove Debris, which was a demonstration satellite that was trialing some technologies for debris removal. Yeah. And it had a net, and it had, which was once it was deployed to capture a CubeSat, and it also had a harpoon experiment, which was where we deployed a plate and then fired a harpoon to see that it could be kind of held that way.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So that was launched on the space station. In fact, I remain amazed that NASA was happy with the idea of this harpoon going onto the space station and then the astronauts manhandling it out of the airlock. But yeah, they seem to be okay.
Can we expect to see any more developments in those sorts of fields? And
you mean debris removal?
Yeah.
I definitely. I mean, it's absolutely a big area at the moment, and especially with the kind of mega constellations that are coming out through, the likes of OneWeb and Starlink and so on. A different approach to that kind of debris removal is required if you're going to put thousands of satellites in orbit with an expectation that, there will be some attrition, that some of them just aren't going to work.
Yeah.
You need to make sure that you've got a way of removing them. There are plenty of organizations now looking at those kind of removal technologies and trialing them out. We actually built another satellite that launched fairly recently for a company called Astroscale, who are doing some of those debris removal, aiming to provide those debris removal services. And we built a target satellite, which launched attached to a bigger satellite, and then the plan is to deploy that, and then they will go through various experiments to see if they can capture it again and test that process of finding and attaching to a satellite which needs to be removed.
Yeah, somebody once said to me that removing satellites from orbit is a bit like finding a cricket ball in the Sahara.
Yes. And unfortunately, it's not a stationary cricket ball either.
That's right. So it's not an easy task. And it's good to know that companies are already thinking about that sort of thing. I understand there is something called a space tug now that can latch onto a satellite and move it into a different orbit. Is that something else that you're involved in?
It's not something we're working on. But no, yes, you're right. There are concepts now around for... having satellites that can go and find another satellite, latch onto it and do something with it. Maybe for in geostationary orbit, certainly there are people looking at, well, can I take a satellite up that will connect to a geostationary satellite and provide additional propellant so that it can stay there for longer?
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. So yeah, that's definitely going on.
And reprogrammable satellites, I understand, are the new thing.
I guess so. I mean, I guess it depends what you think of as reprogrammable. Of course, I mean, certainly, I think. Well, ever since that first satellite back in 40 years ago that Martin Sweeting launched, our satellites have had onboard computers which are programmable from the ground, so you can replace that the software that's running on board and get it to do something else.
Certainly
when Martin used to do that on Eurosat 1, he was having to program it based on a punch card that he had to feed into a machine.
Lord.
Fortunately, we're not doing that anymore.
Luckily.
but certainly the satellites are reprogrammable. I guess what's a little bit new now is just the extent to which those satellites can be reprogrammed, and maybe if you've got a very complex communications payload, can it also be reprogrammed to work in different frequencies or do something a little different.
One of the things that's coming out very clearly, and unfortunately, Andrew, we don't have any more time, much as we'd love to carry on talking to you. But one of the things that's coming out at the moment is that the satellite business is booming. There are satellite launches, thousands or hundreds of them every year. And there's some really incredible kit being thrown up there. But in terms of the business itself, if you were a young person today in school, how would you see it? Would you see it as a mature industry that, well, you don't want to get into, you go for something else that's a bit more exciting? Or are we still at the beginning of the satellite industry?
I think it's very much still an exciting industry. I mean, I guess I would say that, but I would definitely encourage young people to get involved. It's something that is, there are still so many new avenues. There are so many new topics and things to be looking at we should definitely be able to keep anybody interested.
Yeah, that's good. And I guess that in future years, you'll be taking a spaceship up there to have a look at them yourself, will you?
Yeah, certainly. If I can find somebody who's prepared to take me, absolutely.
I'll have a word with Richard Branson for you.
Get Elon Musk on the line.
Yeah.
Andrew, thanks ever so much for that. It was fascinating. And I'm sure we could find about 5 more programs out of all of that. But thank you for your time. Thank SSTL for their time. And, the best of luck with your new satellites.
It's been great. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Of Surrey Satellite Technology Limited. Well, with over 30 years in business and over 70 satellites launched, it is clear to see that the company has a bright future as part of the Airbus Group. Its current portfolio includes several satellites, but I do think the most exciting is perhaps the new Lunar Pathfinder mission, which will establish a communication satellite in orbit around the moon. So who knows which moons or planets SSTL will be putting satellites around in the future. Well, our thanks again to Andrew and to SSTL, and we look forward to you joining us next week for another great iSci Flyby show. Have a great week, and bye for now.